wanted to begin with a very few short remarks of Ashkofa, which I think are essential. And the tachlis of the shir is not to give really a comprehensive review. I don't think that's what's called for. But rather, the tachlis of the shir is to focus on practical experience and details that we need to be aware of. I would begin by noting the Gemara in Chulin. The Gemara in Chulin is at the end of Tzadik Beis, Amud Aleph. The Gemara cites a pasuk in Zechariah, "Va'omer aleihem, in tov b'neichem, hobu schori, if it is good in your eyes, give my schar." And they were given Shloshim Kesef. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Elu Shloshim Tzadiki Umos Olam, Shumos Olam is Kaimu Malay. These are 30 righteous people of the non-Jewish world, which sustain the entire world. Ula Omar, Elu Shloshim Mitzvah, Shetiblu Aleim B'nei Noach. The Gemara surprisingly has 30 mitzvahs that the B'nei Noach accepted. And Rashi writes, Lonis Parshu, where exactly what these mitzvahs are, Rashi says, I do not find mentioned any place that the non-Jewish world has 30 mitzvahs. Of the 30, the only three that they actually observe, the Gemara says. Achas, Shem Koisku, Subul Eschorim. Rashi writes, even though they are choshed on Mishkav Zoho, and this is a part of their lifestyle, but they know in Kalas Rosh B'mitzvahs of Kolkach Sheyichtavu Lehem Ksuvim. They do not formalize marriage between partners of the same gender. V'achash in Koislim Sarames B'makailin, they don't sell human flesh in the meat markets. And in some measure, they're mechabiter. I heard an interpretation of this Gemara many, many years ago from Eliezer Plachinsky Shlita. He said, the world stands ultimately on the fulfillment of Leisinov and Leisirzach, with those of the Yisoides upon which the world stands. And Chazal Ula came to explain that the world has violated Leisinov and Leisirzach wantonly. And yet why does it find Kiyum? Mitzvah Salim Hashem is Kaimim Ha'ilam. It's because there's at least some vestige of the observance of Leisinov and Leisirzach. The vestige of the observance of Leisinov is that despite the fact they violate that Issa which the Torah calls to Ha'ilam Mishkav Zohar, they are not that arrogant that they want to formalize this ritual marriage license for us. Murder, unfortunately, is part of the world in which we live in. Despite the fact they violate Leisirzach, but nevertheless, they don't take human flesh and sell it in the meat market. There's some vestige of shame that's associated yet with these Yisurim. They can't wantonly violate them. As we know, the consumption of human flesh is one of the foremost, use the world that the secular world would use as one of the foremost taboos which exist in civilized society, and the travail that those, in fact, that crashed in the Andes a number of years ago and survived by the consumption of human flesh is itself eye-opening as to how deeply embedded this is in the human consciousness. What shall we say when we live in an age where the agenda of the world we live in, to formalize the marital status of that which the Torah calls to Eivor is a world which is totally antithetical to the notions of Kedusha that we have. We'll come to that notion of Kedusha in a moment. But a world which is totally antithetical to our notions of Kedusha. It's the world that we live in. The world that we live in, the world that we raise our children in. If there was once a convergence, at least in an outer formal sense, between society's moral standards and ours, it still exists within my memory. But in the last 40 years, the world has drastically moved in a very different direction. A world that most of my listeners could not even see destroyed because it didn't exist at all in your lifetime. At the very end of Parshas Achrei, there's a remark of the Sforno, where there's not at all editions of the Sforno, and the edition put out by Moshe Rav Kook. The Torah writes at the very end, "Ushmartem es mishmarti, livilti asois michukos av ta'evois." So it says you should observe those things which are mishmeres, and mishmeres usually means a gedder, livilti asois michukos av ta'evois. And it's referring back, he has called a toivo Yisrael also anshe yaoretz biknanim violated arayas in wholesale fashion, and therefore they were driven, the Torah tells us, from Eretz Yisrael. Ushmartem es mishmarti. And as the Sforno explains, shimru gam es hamitzvah shetzivisi l'shmira v'gedah. Observe those mitzvahs which I have given you as a shmira and a gedah, as a boundary to keep you from violating that which is truly immoral. Shalai tich shalu b'chol eila. The gedah shalai tich shalu b'chol eila. So that you should not come to violate all the moral standards that the Torah has established, in which whose violation was typical of Kanani society. And what are these gedorim? Kuma v'isrei macholos, the limitations of macholos, v'tumas nida, the hilchos nida, v'zogo, v'yoledes, v'zulosa. You will not become tamei in all the ta'evas. But the Sforno is telling us that we observe a world which is capable of kias kolak ta'evo Yisrael also anshei ha'aretz. What is our protection that we should not fall victim to being involved in those ta'evas? If we observe those mitzvahs which the Rambam would classify in the Sefer of Kedusha. If we observe those mitzvahs which are given, the Shmira v'Geder shalo tich shalo b'chol eva, not only are they mitzvahs in their own right, they are mitzvahs which are gedorim, which prevent us from sliding wholesale into all the abominable acts which can take place in the world around us. And the observance of Hilchos Nida is one of them. The essence of Kedusha, the non-Jewish seven mitzvahs of Bnei Noach, the mitzvahs that the Rabbeinu Shalom gave him, enable him, if he observes them, to recognize the Rabbeinu Shalom and live in civilized fashion in this world. It's a system of law, of basic morality, so that he can live as a civilized person. But the human, as constructed, if he lives on his own devices, he is ultimately enslaved by his own biology. His own biology dictates what he will do and what he won't do and his limits and his parameters. Man very rarely has is capable of exercising the bechira to transcend his biological drives and needs. The Rabbeinu Shalom are granting us Taryag Mitzvahs, has given us the ability to be Mekadosh ourselves, to live for something higher than the biological call of the human being. That's the very essence of Kedusha. The Forshim tell us, a non-Jew may bring Karbonos in the Mikdash, but a non-Jew cannot bring a Shlomo in the Mikdash. A non-Jew can live his life at times as a very holy inspiration, he can serve the Rabbeinu Shalom, and at other times he's very earthy. It is solely through the Mitzias of Torah that we can have Simon Reish Lamed Aleph in the Shulchan Aruch, that Bechol Drachecha Da'eyu, that while living a material existence, and within that material existence, we can experience Kedusha. The non-Jew could bring a carbon oil. There's no carbon of a shlomo for a non-Jew. So sense that you have of Kedusha is if he dedicates it fully to the Rebbeinu Shalom. As soon as he is personally involved in it, he cannot maintain sight of what that Kedusha is. That is the special gift that the Rebbeinu Shalom has given us, that we can live in this world, in our earthly material existence, and yet experience the presence of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in everything that we do. And thus, Shlomen, which we eat, Mishulchan Gavaya, we're as guests of the Rebbeinu Shalom, and the experience of the Achila is no less an experience of Kedusha than the most transcendent mitzvah that Klal Yisrael has, is the very gift of Kedusha that Rabbeinu Shlomo has given us. He struggled, his mitzvahs are not easy, because to transcend ourselves, to rise above the baser instincts that a human being has, to discipline ourselves, is the most difficult of tasks in the world. But that's what the Sforno tells us, that besides the mitzvahs of Kedusha being mitzvahs in their own right, but they provide us with very, very special disciplines which enable us to resist all the ta'ivas of the world. So thus the halachas, which are very significant in our own right, of achalas asubas, Kedusha, and our intimate affairs of life, are what empower us to withstand the phenomenal tidal wave to Eva, which exists in the world around us. A world where we live in, which is totally antithetical to our values, which rejects our values as being backwards, as not being progressive and embracing liberty, freedom, and dignity of every human being. Very noble words they use to justify the basest instincts of the human beings. And we have to live in that world, and we can live in that world through the Kedusha that we can find in the mitzvahs that the Rabbeinu Shalom has given us, overcome all the nisyonos hachayim that we face in the contemporary society in which we live. I want to touch a number of areas of halacha. And as I said, the tachlis of this review is not to go give a comprehensive review. If I wanted to give a comprehensive review, we would have to make it spread out over quite a while. And I don't think that this is the audience who needs a comprehensive review. I think that my listeners, by and large, are quite knowledgeable in the halachos of Nida. The question is to touch upon the finer points of that which we need to remember. We'll start off with something very, very elementary, but nevertheless it's an area which needs chizuk. And the simplest really of the halachas of Hilchos Nida is the fact that at the end of the 5 days of separation, the first 5 days, to make a hefsek tyra before we begin counting the seven nikiyim. And the stresses which exist in today's world, with women typically, all even young women of child-rearing age and with young children in the house, out of the house most of the day, and pursuing careers besides their domestic responsibilities, it gets harder and harder to remember, particularly in the winter months of the year, when the Shkia is relatively early, to do the Hefsek Tyra before Shkia. But one must do a Hefsek Tyra before Shkia. And there may be certain heterim for certain shas adchak at times if something is done just after the Shkia. But we have to be very, very careful if it's not become a lifestyle. I learned a lesson in what Adin L'Chatchila means. A lesson that took me, that shook me to my core. I was not so young when I learned it. and it took me a good number of days to assimilate it. Kishazachisi, she spent time with Moron Rabbi Yosef Shlita 20 some odd years back, over a little over 20 years ago. The first shayla that I asked him a certain shayla that was needed, that important what the shayla was. And I wrote a raya from the Taz with what I thought was an appropriate psak. And I did subsequently find, it must be a pretty good raya, because Rav Hozhner of Bnei Brak, in fact, in his tshuvas, paskins the shayla based on that raya, is machriya lahalocha like that. So Rav Yosef asks me, he says, is it a question that's necessary for a woman to conceive or not? He said, lav v'dafka. So he said, if that's the case, v'chimit neisha ono b'damim nasa ma'isa, it's a loshen of shas, well, we have a comparison, but we're not 100% sure that we're right. And apparently, because there are other interpretations of this halacha besides the Taz. So therefore, it's not kedai to be making the chatchila, he told me. I walked around, was blown away. I didn't know what hit me. This happened probably on a Thursday. For a few days, I just couldn't come back to earth. I spoke to a person that what is necessary was capable, was a master of finding of heter agumus. He could take the most chomodik shaylus and kol haTorah kulo, find a teirim when no one else could and take responsibility for it. And here, the shayla wasn't a deraisa. And even a one-time deraisa, it was an isa derabbanan. It's a shayla that he was masking with the evidence mutter. For a shas of chak, it's mutter. So the question reduced itself of what's the lachatchila for an isa derabbanan. And his response was, I literally did not know what hit me for around 3 days. I walked up, I thought I was, the earth split open. The chaymer hadin that he had for a lachatchila of an isa derabbanan shook me to my core. So, if we may find the Torah at times, if we do have Satara Leif Eloi said, that cannot be a lifestyle. It would be very, very reductive to do it in Pushkin. Now, I've come up with an Eitzah which deals with the fact, one of the shyest, which occurs most frequently that I have, is women remember long after Shkia, the night of the Hefzik Tire, that they're supposed to do a Hefzik Tire. And there's nothing that can be done about that, and the day is, well, a whole day is down the tubes. So I spent a lot of time being Ma'ayan, and I've asked others, this Choshev Rabbanim, they've agreed with me, that I tell everyone now that comes to me, on the day that you're supposed to do a Hefzik Tira, is when you wake up in the morning, make a Bedika, full-fledged Bedika. Ayda Halacha says, and only Bedika Shachas is inappropriate. It's only kosher to the Eved in most cases. Einachanam. In the afternoon, they should make a regular Hefzik Tira, they're supposed to. But in the morning when they wake up, they didn't start the hustle and bustle of the day yet, so that they could be very readily remember to do. If, perchance, they get caught up in the business day, their responsibilities, and chasing the little kids, and they remember after Shkia, so they'll come ask a shayla at that point. In 99% of the cases, we'll be able to be seimach on that hefzik tira which was done in the morning. So it's not a lachatchila. This is a backup for a very, very common problem. So this is what I instruct anyone that comes to me with the shayla, that henceforth, when you wake up in the morning of the day of the hefzik tira, do it with the then do what you're supposed to in the afternoon, besides. But in case you don't, in 99% of the situations, we'll be able to save the situation.
Yeah, but what?
You mean after Netzach Hama?
The
truth of the matter is, in all probability, no. I don't see, a daytime Bedika has to be after Netzach. Stavro, listen up, this will come to in a moment, that all daytime Bedikas have to be after Netzach. It may not necessarily be the case in this particular case. I don't want to be nichnas to that. We'll leave it to Chachila to do it after Nates. All Bedikas that have to be done, daytime Bedika, should be done with Chachila after Nates. Now, the main law, what comes out from that is the following, that it's going to get worse in the calendar year 2007, because we currently have the latest sunrise in the city of New York is already at 7:20 in the morning, and we're probably going to add about another half an hour to that, because we're going to go about 2-3 weeks later. Into November, this coming year. So we're probably going to wind up with sunrise creeping closer, a lot closer to 7:45 or so, something. I didn't check exactly. So the chatchilo, one is supposed to do the, any daytime bedika after the sun rises. Bidiyevet, if one did it before, and realize that I didn't realize until afterwards, as long as it was done after Amar HaShachar, after daybreak, one of the yaitzim is a daytime bedika. Now, the most critical bedikas, as we know, in Hilchos Nidah, the Hefset Taira, one bedika in Yom Rishon, and one bedika in Yom Shvi. I'll tell you something very surprising, almost counterintuitive. Kibalti, that for those women that will only be doing one bedika on those days, particularly the Yom Shvi, that they should do the bedikas in the morning and not in the afternoon. And so the Adam Godel who taught this to me said, you're not going to find such a halacha in all of Yoredeya. If you examine it, it's neither backwards and forwards, and you won't find such a halacha. He says, but it's a halacha menschlichkeit. It makes people a lot calmer when they've already taken care of what they have to, and they don't have to run around the whole day worrying about it. This is menschlichkeit is the chodecha tale from the Torah. Menschlichkeit is also part of the Torah. Now just a few notes about bedikas. It's very, very important for practical reasons not to use cloths that are too big. Basically a cloth that's more than about 3 etzboys by 3 etzboys, there's little reason to use. And it can cause a great deal of difficulty. Because one has to do the bedikah in a very confined area, and if the bulk is very significant, it's very, very irritating. So you should be very careful not to make huge, you know, bedikah cloths. I mean, the commercial size ones that they sell are a very appropriate size. And if you, for whatever reason, are tearing up an old undershirt and making one, keep them to that size. Don't let them get much bigger than that. Now, in general, you should stay away from bedikah cloths that are polyester. Polyester is rough and irritating. You should stick to cotton. Cotton is much more comfortable. Now, furthermore, you should also take a cloth which has a tight weave to it. Yeah, there are cloths, if you look at them, they seem like there are little boxes in between. The weave is not very tight. It is very, very hard to pass them appropriately maris on those bedikah cloths. And inevitable when the eye, because the eye does not see one smooth surface, it's a little bit wavy. And in general, when every eye sees things as wavy, I cannot tell you the reason why, but this is the common experience of all Rabbanim, the Paschal Mishailas, is that one tends to see the Shailas more chumra. Colors, for whatever reason, when the surface is less than smooth, the colors get skewed to the darker edge of the spectrum. I cannot tell you the reason, I'll leave that to those that study color and vision, etc., to understand why it's the case, but the experience is very typical of Rabbanim de Paschal Mishailas. So the tight weave is something that's very, very important. Now, a woman that finds herself getting irritated by the bedikah cloths, there are two things that she can do. The simplest and most acceptable eitzah is to make them wet, wring them out, which makes them a lot softer than they are. And for most people, that will resolve the problem. If that doesn't resolve the problem, then they can use something like KY jelly, but they should keep it to a minimum to make sure that the cloth has enough absorption to it that it can pick up the bedikas that are inside, any material which may be internal. Now, I want to look a little bit. Our observance of Hilchos Nidah really comes in reality, I would say, in two parts. Is the days after a woman has become a nida until she goes to the mikveh again. And then there are the days of Prisha, because of the anticipation of the best, which we call Yom HaVest, or Yom HaVest. Now, on Yom HaVest, it's rather surprising to most people, but on Yom HaVest, one is supposed to wear a white underwear the entire day. And at night, to take it off and to check it to see if nothing has happened during that entire event, or, you know, which would render our anida. The reason for this halacha, if you look in the Yeridei, you'll find the Fiske Tshuva 6 quotes to Chavos Das. And the Chavos Das said that on a Yom HaVest, a woman should wear a Meich Dochuk the entire day. Yeah. That we know in our practical experience that even the short amount of time, that once a month that they do a Meich Dochuk, is very, very irritating to most women, or many women. And certainly if they have to do it a number of times a month for an entire day, it would be very, very difficult. The minig did not follow that particular course. The Moshe Zatzal said in its place that we have to wear white the entire day and to check it when we take it off at night. So this is a halacha which is not widely known, but a very, very essential halacha in terms of observing Yom HaVest. Now, principally, on Yom HaVest, they're very cheap. It suffices that one do one bedika at close to the end of the vest itself. If one didn't do it during the vest, one could do it even if it's over our vest, subsequent to the vest as well. Now for daytime bedikas, for a daytime prisha, if the owner's in the daytime, so somewhere in the latter part of the day, from Tlagam Imchanan, and that part of the day before Shkia, is the appropriate time to do the bedika. The problem is in the nighttime bedikas, when really is the time to do them. Practically for most people are not making, getting up in the middle of the night to make them. So for most people tend to make the bedikah for the night time, you know, in the morning as soon as they get up. So those are the practicalities of it. Now, how do we count, how do we calculate the vest itself? This is also not a very simple matter, because the onset of the vest for most women does not just happen in one instant that she's in high gear and the damnida comes forth in significant force. Practically what happens in the breakdown of the uterine lining, you often first have brownish colored mars, which are merely the tissue itself which is breaking down internally, which does not really contain dominance. It's merely the tissue buildup. Eventually, as the tissue begins to break down, it reaches the point where the blood vessels are, and the blood vessels crack open, and that's the damnida which comes forth and drains from the goof at that particular point. As the process begins, it may go from some brownish spotting to a little bit of reddish spotting to a real flow. Now, at what point does one count the Yom HaVest? It's a very, very tricky area, one that's subject to many, many answers. And what I suggest you to do is that you follow the time when the major flow begins. So therefore, let's say she starts to spot, and it's the daytime. The major flow doesn't start coming through the nighttime. That you count the Yom HaVest as the vest came in the nighttime. Now she may in fact become a sura before that. She may in fact have enough staining, or one will realize retroactively one was perished because one was concerned that the spotting in the daytime was the start of the vest. And then it's confirmed, the nighttime comes, and you see that this is indeed the onset of the vest. So now you know for sure that what you were concerned with in the daytime, that she is a sura, is true. So she became actually also in the daytime. Now, as long as there's a prisha, the mitzaradin in the daytime, one could count that as part of the 5 days. So here the prisha was mitzaradin. The mitzaradin could be a yom HaVest, the prisha could be she had a kesem, it could be it was the start of the vest. Anything which halachically rendered her asura is enough to start the counting of the 5 days. But the yom HaVest itself stems from the major flow. I do want to just to go to an aside, which is a factor in this, and it's There are varied manifestations today of it, which one has to be very, very careful about. And that is in postpartum, after a woman has given birth particularly, it gets very difficult to distinguish between summer and a vessel. Because the early periods subsequent to labor tend to be very, very light. And one can almost dismiss them as being merely summer. So in that particular experience, you have to be very, very careful. If she suddenly starts to stain and is persistent to come to ask a shayla, personally, after a lot of practical ear into it, I came to the conclusion that in such a situation when a woman is rather unlikely to see a full-fledged breast because she's postpartum, if the staining continues for a third straight day, sporadic, but a little staining of one day, the second, or the third day, but the third day I decided it's a breast, and she has to observe 5 and 7. So sometimes it's what tells us that it's a breast. We can look at each particular detail and explain all the details later. But if we look at the collective set of details, then we see something differently than we see at each particular point along the way. We see the forest rather than just the trees. So this is something that one has to be very careful about. There is another manifestation of this, which a number of Rabbanim have begun to discuss, principally. There were older Rabbanim are like-minded and have discussed, you know, so far this matter. I hope soon, in fact, that maybe I'll have a psak from Rabbi Yoshe on it as well. But there are women that use for contraceptive purposes the IUD. And it, nowadays, it rendered certain forms of the IUD safe again. It's come back into use. I rarely, for certain reasons, rarely give a heck before it. That's something else with IUD altogether. But women that use it, now they've combined with the hormone Marina, I believe it's called, if I've pronounced it correctly. And the end result of this is that they see one tipa of dam a month. In Eretz Yisrael, they call it tipach chodshit, the monthly drop of blood. So you should render a needle from this. Now, pashtus is, since it comes in a periodic fashion, from month to month, it comes on a cyclical basis, but this is dam needle. My partly, why should I be concerned with how much the dam needle is? And the Shach Sof Kosov writes in the very beginning of Ruchos Nidah, there are filo tipas dam techarda. A drop of blood not bigger than a mustard seed. And the Shach says, that's also lav v'dafka. The smallest amount of dam can render a person a needle. So the fact that the smallness of the amount does not change the fact that this is something which is coming from cyclical bleeding, which ought to be rendered as dam nida. That's all. If there's a significant amount of time, that I don't want to get into the child, it's a very complicated child. What I'm talking about right now is if she spots and the flow comes within 24 hours, to count it from the flow. If it's longer than that, that needs a deal in each individual case. Now I want to turn my attention a little bit, let's go back a little bit to how do we count the vestas? There's a lot of confusion in that, so let's be very clear. Day of the Re'iyah is day number one. The day of the next Re'iyah is both the final day in last month's Re'iyah and the first day of the next month. So if, for example, suppose she saw the first time on Aleph Nisan, she saw the second time on Lamed Nisan. So that's a 30-day cycle. Aleph the first day, Lamed the last day. For the next cycle, we now start from Lamed. Lamed is now the first day of the next cycle. So when we get up to Chof Tes Iyar, there will also be 30 days. So that we need to know. Just push it at a count. Keep the count appropriate. The day that she sees is the first day, And the next time she sees it is both the last day of the last cycle and the first day of the next cycle. Now, there is a lot of confusion. I doubt in this audience that I'm going to have someone that's confused in that regard, but inevitably people that teach Hilchos Nida bump into this problem that the Hefsek Taira is not Yom Aleph. 7 days begin the day after the Hefsek Taira. So thus typically, if you do a Hefsek Taira on Sunday, you go to the mikveh the next Sunday night. Because Monday is day one and the next Sunday is day seven. There are some people in the world that get confused and they count Monday as day two. Not uncommon. But we do need just to keep that in mind, not to fall into such a rut. Now, one other thing that we need to know is, suppose, for example, the woman made a Hefsek Taira, an appropriate Hefsek Taira. The next day was Yom Aleph, and she forgot to do any Vedik on Yom Aleph. Now what happens? So now I had Monday before Shkia was a Hefsek Taira, Tuesday there was no Vedik. You can't have a Yom Aleph without a Vedik. So what happens next? So what happens is that the next day, Wednesday, is now going to be Yom Aleph. It does not destroy the Hefsek Taira. Hefsek Taira is halacha in its own right. There's no halacha which obligates the fact that seven Nikiyim have to come immediately on the heels of the Hefsek Taira. So even if she happened to miss a day, okay, so she's a day behind, but she doesn't lose. The Hefsek Taira is still a Hefsek Taira. So we had a Hefsek Taira on Monday towards evening before the Shkia. Tuesday was wiped off the map because she forgot to do the mitzvah. Now Wednesday is day one. So Wednesday being day one, in this case, you wind up going to the mikvah the next Tuesday night. Now, before the Hefsek Taira, they're supposed to wash externally and somewhat internally too. Because the tachlis of the Hefsek Taira, of the washing before the Hefsek Taira, the point of the Hefsek Taira is to conclude that she's not bleeding at this particular moment. How much exactly it's supposed to prove, if you want to learn a very, very fascinating tshuva, Ramesh has a very lengthy and revolutionary tshuva on what exactly the Hefsek Taira is supposed to prove. The subject, the title of the tshuva has to deals with when he told people to do a new Hefsek Taira after they had a bedikah which was inappropriate, and when he didn't tell them to do a new Hefsek Taira. That's the title of the tshuva. It's a very fascinating tshuva because Rav Moshe goes through the entire Indian of what the Hefsek Taira is and what his first 3 days are. His whole shita, in Hilchos Nida, he goes to a tour de force as only he could with all his koichos. It's a very, very fascinating tshuva. It's one window on the sugya of Hefsek Taira. But to whatever measure it's supposed to establish that something about the bleeding stopped. And that's established. Kol's man that we don't find the new bedikah was done. If we miss the next day, so we're just one day behind. The next day after that will be day one. So we need to walk, to be washing internally is to establish when she does the bedikah now, why is she finding done? If she finds something, is she finding it because she's bleeding presently, she's staining, or she's finding it because this is just left from before? If you cut your finger and you don't wash it off, so at the end, you're going to have some blood on your fingertip. If you wipe your hand off with something else, you're going to have a red stain. But that may be, I may have long finished bleeding, but I have some clotted blood on my finger, maybe a little moist from external other liquids, and I'll wipe it, and I'll have a nice red spot. But that's not indicative that there's not a Hefsek Taira enough. So to be able to appropriately make a Hefsek Taira, first he has to wash out, so that any residue of the dam nida is removed, and now she'll first be able to tell if she's actually able to make a Hefsek Taira or not. Just one note, during the Zayin Nikiyah, the will of Ronan, usually I say, unless there's certain unusual situations where a woman gets a het and not the will of Ronan, but under normal circumstances, we wear levonim. Rashi in the Sechta Shabbos tells us that the wearing of the levonim is for the purpose, it's a form of bedikah. It's another form of bedikah. There are internal bedikahs, there are external bedikahs. The wearing of levonim is an external bedikah. Now, one of the subjects that Poskim discuss is what exactly, you say that there are no spots on Bigdei Tzivoinim, on colored clothes, you find spots on Bigdei Tzivoinim, of Ksomim, so there's no Gzeira on Bigdei Tzivoinim. The question of what that entails. Among the Chassidish Poskim, they are inclined this only includes very dark colors. All pastels, according to them, are in the realm of white. Ramosha Zatzal was very strong for the fact that white is white. Anything that's beige, pastels, no matter how light they may be, but they're not white, are not white. But Hayyitzim is there something else that one does have to be careful not to use as Tachtonim get older and they get discolored and they're no longer so white that it really is not inappropriate to be using them during the Zion Nikir. They still have to be whitish. After a while, they lose their whiteness, which is really inappropriate to be used in Zion Kiyum or on those days that one needs to do for a check for the Yom HaVest itself. I want to talk a little about Chatzitzis. Basically, the Chatzchila, despite the fact that the halacha is halacha psuka, and the Shulchan Aruch and in many places in Shas, that a mi'a che'eno makpid is not a chatzitza. The raisa, a chatzitza, is only something which covers robe of the gut, or perhaps robe of the hair, that's a shayin or whatever, machlokes the goinim, the rishayinim. If the hair is considered an area of the body on its own, or as part of the goof as a whole, it's a shayla. But it has to cover robe, and one has to be makpid. Then with the raisa, it's a chatzitza. The rabbanon for moisif is a siog. If it's a roiv, one is not makpid, or it covers mir taguf, and one is makpid. In both of those cases, that those are chatzitzas with the rabbanon. What remains true is that a miyot, an anal makbet, is mutter even midrabanan, it's not a chatzitza. But nevertheless, the halacha is reported in Hilchos Nidah that we are makbet, the chatchila, that we should not even have a chatzitza of miyot she'ena makbet. The goof should be entirely nochi. There are issues which fall in areas which are not so simple to ascertain the halacha, or do we consider makbid or ain't makbid? Kahayim azeh, at this moment in time, I may not be makbid, but it's not something that I plan to keep there forever. And stitches are always a problem for this reason. And stitches on one hand, if a person needs stitches, a person wants the stitches there until they heal. But on the other hand, they have no intention of keeping the stitches there, it'd be a segayah leaver. The poiskim are machmer that stitches are chatzitza, except if they are dissolvable stitches that one does not have to remove from the goof, they just fade away on their own. The poiskim are makel, since nothing has to be done, and once I put them there, I don't do anything to remove them. The poiskim are makel in this regard. The casts, for the same reason, casts are a very similar problem. A person that needs a cast on one of the external organs of the body, both the foot, the arm, etc., have to go on a cast. To the very largest extent, the Rabbanim are not matter to go to the mikvah with a cast. In certain situations, when it becomes it's a very lengthy problem, a big shas of Havodah, the person has to ask for Shaila. In certain situations, there may be some attention. We'll come to that in a minute. Now, once one leaves the surface of the body and enters, based on storm, internal parts of the body, but internal parts which are exposed to the outside, like the internal part of the mouth, etc. So there's interesting, there's a machlokes in Kiddushin between the Ritva and Tosfos. The Gemara says that these places don't need bias mayim, they don't need water to come there, but they have to be royal with bias mayim. So the question is, a chatzitza in these places when they're not royal to be a smile, that's a deraisa dikadim or the rabbanon dikadim. It's a machlokes in the rishonim. And principally, all the heterim that the place can have, the things that are within the mouth, stem from the fact of relying in combination on the shita that Beis Hashem is only derabbanan. Now, for example, what happens if they one has temporary fillings on the teeth? This has always been a big mavuch on the poskim. What to do? Is it a chatzitza? Is it not a chatzitza? It's a very, very complicated subject. And the first two, preferably, what one should do, preferably, is number one. And this, Rabbi Yosef told me, the biggest tzad lehokol that he has in this shayla stems from the Marsham. The Marsham, Kidarko Bakoydish, the Marsham had a phenomenal kayak that day. He was a goyim of unbelievable proportions. So he was Machadish Aswar. It says that if the temporary one does not, filling, for example, does not take up any more room than the permanent one is, so that means the area where the water doesn't come to is always going to, is going to be covered. So it's going to be considered Balua, and it's never going to need Tefillah. So Mamela, what do I care why it's never going to need Tefillah? It's not never going to need Tefillah because it's covered by something that's there today, or it's never going to need tefillah by something which else is going to replace it and remain there for the next 50 years. But this area is always going to be a mokum balua, which will never need tefillah. So the Rabbi Yosef told me to be very careful if a person is having dental work done and they're putting in a temporary filling, to ask the dentist to file it down and to make sure that it does not take up any more area than the permanent one will do. Because usually they're not so matkah to fix it up perfectly. Because it's only there for a few weeks. After a few weeks, they'll take it out. So they'll put in the effort in the permanent one to make sure that it's exact and precise. But in the temporary one, it's kedai with another shayla. And this is a shayla which is a pervasive shayla in the halacha of what is considered something which has a kfiyas to it. And we find varied places in the halacha. Is it 30 days? Is it 7 days? You can have, for example, in Shin Yud Zayin and Nuchos Kshorim, you'll have the same shaylas come up again with the same types of agdars. Lichatchila, it's preferable that if there's a temporary filling that it be in for 30 days. And even preferable that it be in 30 days after the tefillah, possibly. And b'di'evah, there are those that even matter on things in the mouth if they'll be in for 7 days. So these are all shaylas which need to be asked. Now stitches in the mouth is a much more chomerdik problem. If they're non-dissolvable, because they're certainly, they're at least a temporary filling, as we said. You need to have a filling in that particular place. A little more, a little less, and this is in for a week. Stitches in the mouth are a shayla, which are more, is more chumra than that. And a person should come and ask their own shayla. I don't want to get into a public discussion of that. Now, by and large, those people that are very, very, that are nizr, in Hilchos Neva, Nizr, I mean not only Mekayim the Din, but it wanted to be Mekayim the Din in the way that it should be Mekayim. So remove everything, do not grow the nails long, they do not get fancy nails made, manicured, and all types of shines and things put on, because Lichatchila Lozu Adar. This is not the Mesorah that we have and had to be Mekayim this mitzvah, and as I said, our Mesorah is to remove everything from the goof. We have already a long-standing heter from Rav Chaim Oyser, the Tzadik Livrocha, that manicures already became popular in European society. The women didn't want to cut their nails every month. So Rav Chaim Oyser was mad to them to go to the mikveh in that particular fashion. And similarly, if people have nail polish, as long as the nail polish is in such a state that they would still go to a chasana with it, they're not embarrassed to have go up, be seen in public with it, that it doesn't constitute a chatzitza. This is built on the svara that we have, that those things which are lenoi, which are to beautify the body, do not serve as a chatzitza. So there are a terror for these things. Yeah. Do we seek those a terror in the chatzitza? No, we don't seek them in the chatzitza, but the terror do exist. And at times, we may be in the situation of having to give the psak to others. Now, many women like to shave their legs before they go to the mikveh, and it's really they should take care to do it the day before. Don't wait until the day of the mikveh itself, because it's very hard to get rid of all the little hairs that you get off. It does take a little time to rid yourself of it. This way, if they do it the day before, they have a whole day, then they'll bathe. And if they had a mikveh, they have a pretty strong chance of getting rid of everything by the time they go to the mikveh. I wanted to touch on two more areas in brief. One has to do, in general, we need to ask ourselves. We have, the Torah tells us, modesty and privacy are very great values of the Torah. And yet, as a robe that Paskin shines us, sometimes women are embarrassed that I should know who they are when they send me shilas. They send me shilas, they send me a voicemail telephone, and I don't know who they are. Now, they don't do themselves a service when they do that. And the reason for it is because there's a sensitivity in the halacha to many, many factors. Is this a person that's trying to have a child? It's a difficult marriage. Is this a person, for example, that has certain types of maras constantly? Certain people don't have ever certain types of maras. Certain people have certain maras every single day of their life. Now, from among the people that come and ask me, there are some that have been coming since the time they were kala, before they were married. And I know if I'll be machmer on brown, they don't have to bother to go to the mikveh. They can stay home, that's it, you know. There'll be a neither from the time they're married until the day they don't. There'll be no problem, you know. They see brown every day of their life. So they'll never go to the mikveh. So kibal numer amosha for those women, a different set of psokim and had a pasuk, a pasuk ultimately. But then I have to know what the person's profile is. I'm sitting with a Rav in Yerushalayim, Rav Moshe Halberstam Zatzal, and a woman comes in, and she shows him a brown, a kesem, whatever it was, and he's smattering for her. A diva, whatever it was. She knows that. He says to me, she said, no. He says, this is a genetic thing. She says, she has three sisters, they all come to me, and her mother comes and asks me shilas to her. They all have the same shilas. It's genetic. If you hide, and I don't know who you are, so my psak cannot be as good as knowing who you are. Now, I don't know anyone that goes to the doctor, puts on a mask, they call up the doctor, and that the OBGYN has a false name who wears a mask that the doctor shouldn't know who they are. Haven't seen it yet. I'm not saying it doesn't take place, maybe it does, but I haven't heard about it yet. The reason for it is that as mature people, we realize that they have to go to the doctor. And in that setting, it's not a breach of tznius to be candid about things and open about things which one should not discuss elsewhere. And the same as when you come to the rov. And as I say, the psak will be a better psak if I know who I'm dealing with than I don't know who I'm dealing with. When I don't know who I'm dealing with, I have to give you a canned psak, a generic psak. But there are psakim, the din is sophisticated enough that it has a lot of individual psakim to. An individual psukim of an individual case, and I have to know that this is an individual case. Now, in general, we need to know that when there are difficulties, we should not be assuming that things are awesome. There are a lot of things. I always say that there are three levels of placement when it comes to Mars. And it goes like this. There's the women, their husbands, and their abodim. I just went in that order exactly from the most machmer to the most meek. Now, don't assume that things are awesome. It's dumb, it's dumb. But if you're having difficulty, don't assume, don't throw things away. There are many, many tzedakim. Because neither is a very, very complicated, a very complicated subject. The practicalities above the halachas are even more complicated than the halachas themselves. The combination of the two is a very big thing. And therefore, don't make assumptions. There are a lot of tzedakim in halacha which you could spend your whole life and you've never even considered. Because they weren't relevant to you. Rabbonim who have to involve themselves with the broad tzibur, but the broad tzibur we see all types of shaylos. The all types of things which become relevant to you that you don't even realize. You need to ask shaylos. Particularly either women that are having a hard time becoming tahara for whatever reason, or women with fertility issues. And one needs to come and ask, is there something in this particular situation where the rov could find a heter for the woman to go to the mikveh earlier? Which in some cases the answer is yes. There are a whole different set of psukim from Mars for a woman that's trying to conceive. All different, a different shulchan aruch. We put away one shulchan aruch and we take out a different shulchan aruch. If a woman needs to be able to go to the mikveh earlier to conceive. I have a friend, Chassidish of Torah, and he's a successful businessman that I consider. He's a clerk today, Boba Bechassid. He was a Klosenberger Chassid by family. And he spent 5 years in Klosenberger Kollel in Eretz Yisrael because of the bias for the Klosenberger Rebbe as a Chassidic Rebbe. Just to give an example of what happens and what's necessary in a Shasal Chak and what can come from it. So one night, one Friday night, the Klosenberger Rebbe did not come out of the Tish until the wee hours of the morning. Hours and hours after he normally came out for the Tish, he finally came out for the Tish. So my father told me what happened. He was a person that had no children, and they had a shayla on Yom Shvi, and they brought it to the Rebbe Friday night. Everybody died, he couldn't find the heter, they sent it to the Rebbe. The Rebbe sat to learn for hours and hours to be mechadish a heter for this particular mar, for the particular shayla. After many hours of learning, the Rebbe came to a heter. It was matter. The woman went to the mikveh. She conceived that night, and it's the only child she ever had. So, that calls a nichnas in the cheshbon of what Hashem means to ask Hashem. I want to touch one other thing, one other area in short, just to give you a little bit an inkling of what's involved. And this has to do with doctor's visits. Today, medicine is quite sophisticated. There are a wide array of instruments, and tests that doctors do of all different, for all different types of things. And principally, what you need to know, when you go to the doctor, you should ask almost two questions. If they're putting instruments inside, number one is, what is the diameter of the instrument that they're using? And secondly, is how far in do they go? They go to the cervix, to the external ass, to the internal ass, how far do they go? They enter the uterus. You need to ask them how far. Then you can come back and you'll be in a position to have the facts that the rogue needs to be able to pass from the shayla. Typically, for example, pap smears, conventional pap smears, are not a problem. A pap smear, basically what it is, it's a scratch. They scratch the cervix. They scratch off cells with a type of brush. Now, depending, sometimes you make the scratch and you succeed in just getting off cells and you don't scratch to cause bleeding. And other times in the scratch, you scratch a little more and it causes it to bleed. But it's a scratch. That's what the pap smear is. It's a scratch of the cervix, which is an area which is clearly, the dam coming from that scratch is not done either. And it's normal that it bleeds. So if one has a pap smear, by and large, and you come and tell the rabbi, I did a pap smear, and then I saw dam, the rabbi's going to be matzah. Now, principally, the day that one's going to do a hefsek taira is not the day that you want to be doing a pap smear. Because there are two bedikas which are pretty much set in stone, and we have no means of getting around. That's a hefsek taira and a bedika on Yom Aleph. So certainly for the hefsek taira, one needs to. It's going to be near the end of the day. You don't want to do something which could cause bleeding, and then you're not going to have a good hefsek taira. In the middle days is really the best to go, not on Yom Aleph and not on Yom Shvi. Probably 4 or 5 is the best days to go. If you're going to go on a day, you should really do the bedikah in the morning before the test is done, so you get the bedikah of that day. And principally, I would say later, one should normally avoid going later than about day 5. Day 4, day 5, day 4 is probably even better in the Nikiyah. Because for about a day and a half after these, perhaps where you should not do an internal bedikah. The reason for that is because if you'll do an internal and you'll find that, the rabbi is going to be nothing. But the Novi Yehuda said one is better off not doing the bedikah, which is not absolutely mandatory, than doing it and being paid of a matzah subsequent to that. Ramela, I tell people for about a day and a half or so after the pap smear not to do an internal bedikah. So principally, you want to have done Yom Aleph and Yom Shvi, not when you're going to run into problems in the hefsek taira from a pap smear. That's the Ha'oros that I wish to share with you. Just as I said, it did not come for a general review of the halachas, but rather an awareness in some of the details which we may not necessarily be following. The Rebbeinu Shlomo grants. This is part of the shiur I decided to give in conjunction with Urgun Shiur Torah because of Shavuot. This is a time that in Klal Yisrael, particularly in the Chassidish world, minute kodum to stress in Yonim of Kedusha in these weeks. And therefore, it's the reason the shiur took place at this time. May the Rebbeinu Shlomo grant that in our efforts to observe the halachas properly, that we zeicha, in fact, that the Rebbeinu Shlomo should bestow upon us the kedusha that comes from the observance of this mitzvah, and the ability to achieve kachena b'mitzvaseicha, and through that the simchokena b'mitzvaseicha, and to observe the Rebbeinu Shlomo's Torah and exalt it in the most noble sense, and be as a Torah to